Peter Guralnick writes that when he was a freshman in college, his most precious possessions were his blues records and the portable stereo phonograph his mother purchased with green stamps. Guralnick never outgrew his love of the blues. He went on to write books and articles about blues, country, soul music, and rock and roll. His new book is called Searching for Robert Johnson. It's based in part on research done by Houston folklorist Mac McCormick for a book that has remained unwritten. Johnson is one of the most mysterious and revered figures in blues history. He was poisoned by a lover's jealous husband and died in 1938 at the age of 27. Even if you don't know his own recordings, you might know the versions of his songs recorded by others, such as the Rolling Stones' Love in Vain and Eric Clapton's version of Crossroads. Here's Robert Johnson's 1937 recording of Hellhound on My Trail.
And the days keep on worrying me, the hellhound on my trail, hellhound on my trail, hellhound on my trail.
This is the record that you call Robert Johnson's crowning achievement. Why?
Well, I think in a lot of ways it's not just Robert Johnson's crowning achievement, but almost the pinnacle of the blues. It focuses a degree of intensity and a degree of lyrical power with an almost frightening kind of, paranoia is the wrong word, but I mean, it's just a sense of being pursued, a sense of, it's very explicit in the lyrics, but I think what's most extraordinary about it, you couldn't just recite the lyrics, is that the music echoes the lyrical content so precisely and so almost frighteningly that, to my mind anyway, it's something which is both a pinnacle and it's also something which is very difficult to listen to. It's definitely not casual listening.
Do you remember when you first started listening to Robert Johnson's records and what that experience was like and which were the first records or what was the first record that really drew you in?
Well, I remember it vividly because the first album, King of the Delta Blues Singers, came out when I was a freshman at Columbia in 1962. And I can just remember listening to that album over and over and over again. I mean, it was a thrill almost beyond my imagining at this point because it was in such a void. There wasn't anything like it, and there weren't a lot of blues records out at that time. And the thing that was so extraordinary about it was that it wasn't just any blues record, but it represented a whole world, almost a worldview and a poetic vision that I had never picked up before. As much as I loved the blues, and that I don't think I've ever seen replicated since.
It's hard to make out the words even now, and I'm sure it's remastered better now than it was when you first started listening to Robert Johnson. I'm just wondering if that added to the mystery of it and added to your appreciation of it, the sense that it was somehow within reach but out of touch, who he was and what he was singing.
Well, I think that's true. I mean, I think that looking back on it, I don't think there's any question that my friends and I created a romance, I mean, out of Robert Johnson. And to some extent, perhaps that violated the reality of the person and of the artist. We certainly, we argued over lyrics. We would listen and listen. And things that then seemed the subject of such intense debate seem so obvious now. It's almost laughable. But that was part of the attraction, the remoteness of it and the remoteness from our lives. The sense of, this is not something I'm particularly proud of or that I think is anything to be enthralled about, but I think it's this you create this sense of someone living on the edge out of a person who lives a life entirely different from your own. And ultimately, you may find out that you're living as much on the edge as anybody else, but it... You know, I think that you're always looking for that kind of that kind of intensity, I guess.
Yeah, well, you're talking about intensity and living on the edge. I mean, here's a singer who sounds tormented in some of the songs. And some of the songs are about the devil or about having a hellhound on his trail. Were there, what kind of impressions have you gotten about Johnson the man, as far as like how emotionally stable he was? Was he emotionally disturbed when he was recording, when he was singing? When he was alive, is I guess what I'm trying to say here.
See, I guess I would take a more prosaic view of it now. I mean, I would see Johnson, in a sense, as a conscious artist, as someone who was seeking to create a specific effect. And the odd thing is that the more you learn about the person, Mac McCormick described him as a cipher, in a sense, in the views. He gave back exactly what the person he was with wanted to see or find. In my interviews over the years with people like Johnny Shines and Robert Junior Lockwood, who were probably as close to him as anybody, there isn't a strong sense of personality. There's a sense of someone who perhaps was brooding, but who created his music out of an internal strife, say. But certainly it was not evidenced from their descriptions in his external life. And he was a very resourceful guy. He was a person who went out on the streets and he might play the latest Bing Crosby tune or Tumbling Tumbleweeds. He had this memory, he could hear a song once and recreate it note for note, according to Johnny Shine. So, I mean, there was a great deal of technique and a great deal of facility involved. But what made Robert Johnson was, I think, it was, in a sense, the same dedication that you'll find in the work of any conscious artist, of Duke Ellington in a more sophisticated form of music, or a great writer, and that's the sort of thing that comes across to me, which in some ways I suppose is equally romantic, but it's a different kind of romance.
A lot of people like to imagine what it would be like if Robert Johnson had lived, what kind of music he would be playing today. And as you point out in your book, some people say, oh, he would have been a brilliant innovator. But you think not necessarily. You've seen it happen both ways, that someone survives and remains brilliant, and other people even forget their own songs over time.
Yeah, yeah. One of the things that struck me about Robert Johnson is that he was... he seems to me almost a kind of incandescent spirit. I mean, the brilliance of his achievement and the intensity of his music was such that it's hard to imagine it being extended, for too long. In a poetic sense, which is not to say in a real sense, but in a poetic sense, I mean, it almost seems fitting that is certainly to the legend that's been created around Robert Johnson that he should have come to an end in the way that he did, because it's almost as if there was nowhere else for him to go in his music at that point.
I went to the crossroads, fell down on my
knees. You know, I think you have an experience, and you've managed to express it, that a lot of other people have experienced too, and I think it's a very interesting one. I'm thinking of you as a white teenager in a suburb of Boston, hearing music from black rural musicians that was recorded decades earlier, and somehow this music speaking to you with an intensity that no other music ever did before. I don't know, I just find that really interesting to think about in terms of people living very different lives than you do, speaking more directly to your heart.
Well, it's a very peculiar thing, and one that something that I think back on often. The thing that's even odder about it, though, is that it's not something that was confined to the experience of someone like me growing up in a suburban, home in the Northeast in the 50s and I mean, in talking to people like, I was asking Eric Clapton, I interviewed him fairly recently, mm-hmm. and his experience was almost identical, in an entirely different world. And he was talking about how Keith Richards, whom he didn't know at that time, had exactly the same experience with Robert Johnson. There's something both external and internal. I mean, I think there's no question that the exoticness of the music must have been, and perhaps of the experience, must have been something that really appealed to me as a kid and appealed to probably Eric Clapton, Keith Richards, and, you know, a whole generation of people, or part of a generation of people anyway. But there was also something in the music, something intrinsic, that could cut across these barriers of class and background.
Mm-hmm. Have you found it difficult sometimes to write stories about blues musicians in the sense that it was an undocumented music for so many years? So you're relying on memory, which is always pretty unreliable at best. Part of the blues tradition is a sense of bragging and embroidering the truth. I think a lot of musicians probably contradict themselves in the way they remember different things about the past. So is it hard to tell what the real accurate story is when you're writing about somebody's life?
Well, the way I tried to get around that, and I mean, I think I conceived of myself as a fiction writer first, and I conceived of what I was doing here as a kind of portraiture. And in sticking to that portraiture, to some extent, I tried to put whatever I was writing within a perspective, and I tried to offer it relatively flat. I tried to allow people, to one extent or another, represent themselves. And I'm not thinking of a blues man in this particular case, but one of the people that I wrote about in Lost Highway spoke at great length about his invention of rock and roll, about how Elvis had taken everything that he had done from this singer. And it wasn't, by repeating this, it wasn't that I was endorsing this point of view. I felt, and I feel now, that I was allowing this singer to portray himself, mm-hmm. Not in a bad way, not in a good way, but those are the terms in which he sees himself.
I want to talk to you some more about going into another world to write about the musicians. For instance, when you were starting out writing and you would sometimes go south to interview musicians there, did you ever have an identity crisis of, like, who you were, who you should be in this new setting? Like, should you try to be more southern or rural or act more black or something? Or were you comfortable just being whoever you were in a different world with people who you'd listened to a lot but had never met before, and you'd never met people like them before?
I wasn't comfortable with just being who I was, but I was stuck with being just who I was. And I was determined, that I was going to be myself, and I was determined that I was going to show respect to the people that I was interviewing and writing about. And the only way I knew to do that was by not imitating them, by not sort of trying to curry favor with them, by trying to appear to be something that I wasn't. And, you know, I think that to say that is a lot easier for me anyway than to do it. And it certainly caused me a good many anxious moments, but I feel like it was the one form of real respect or real honesty that I could show to the people that I was, that I was willing to be myself, that I presented myself as I was, and that there wasn't any subterfuge in it.
Well, what was one of the most self-conscious or uncomfortable parts about being Peter Guralnick, meeting one of his blues idols?
Well, at the beginning, actually, I mean, you put your finger on it when you say one of my blues idols. I mean, whether it was meeting Jerry Lee Lewis or it was meeting Howlin' Wolf, I mean, these were people that I just revered through their music. And so meeting them caused an enormous degree of self-consciousness on my part. And again, it wasn't a question of either pulling punches or not pulling punches. I mean, I was just interested in giving them the opportunity to sort of portray themselves. But sometimes that opportunity could cause me a good deal of discomfort. I mean, when I spoke with Jerry Lee Lewis originally, he just was so disinclined to do any kind of an interview, and he was sort of so anxious or willing to put any interviewer off balance, that it was certainly an I mean, there I was with my Jerry Lee Lewis International Fan Club card in my wallet, and you know, and just trying to keep up with him, I guess. But I, you know, it's the kind of thing where, for instance, when I interviewed Johnny Jenkins, who was the person who started out with Otis Redding and sort of served to some extent as Otis Redding's mentor, and never really got outside of Macon, there was a tremendous amount of bitterness on his part towards the world at large, perhaps towards the white world in particular. And Otis Redding's brother, Rogers, dropped me off in Johnny's front yard, and I stood outside of his house while he just excoriated, not me personally, but as I say, the world at large and the white world in particular. And it was just, you know, I didn't really have much alternative. I wasn't totally in disagreement with him, but at the same time, it was a relatively uncomfortable position to be in. But I, you know, I just stayed and I tried to. I didn't demean myself. I didn't, you know, I didn't jump right in and say, "You're right, I'm terrible, I'm terrible." But eventually, you know, he said, "Well, he didn't mean anything personally," and we went indoors, and he was great.
You're in the process of writing a book about Elvis Presley. What are you looking at exactly with Elvis? What's your Elvis story that you're going to tell?
What I'm looking at is something which, in some ways, I don't think has been done before, and yet it's the most logical thing to do, is to put Elvis in a social and a musical context, to see a kid growing up in Memphis, to see to someone with a mind, you know, in a lot of ways, similar to Robert Johnson's, that could soak up music of all sorts from every direction, and then create a new kind of synthesis, and someone who is so voracious for experience and voracious for musical experience. I mean, that's really, I guess, that's what draws me to the subject. And while it will be a biography which will carry through to the end, that's the reason, I think, for writing a book about him, and that's what gives me the impetus.
Peter Guralnick, thanks a lot for talking with us.
Well, thank you.